Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Sam Leith about his book, Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. It's an accessible and entertaining introductory account of rhetorical theory and practice, illuminated by a wide range of examples from across the last three millennia, from Aristotle to South Park. In this interview, we talk about the ubiquity of rhetoric in daily life, and why it exerts such fascination over scholars of language, politics, and poetics alike. We talk about the high style of rhetoric, and the prevalence of the anti-rhetoric rhetoric in contemporary political discourse, and we consider how politicians try to establish their credentials as ordinary people and why that's so often doomed to failure. Today I'm talking to Sam Leith, author of the very entertaining book Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. It's an introduction to how rhetoric has been both used and studied down the ages, and a reflection on how relevant it remains today. Sam, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I mean, the book arose actually out of a newspaper article. I'm a journalist by trade, and I was a sort of journalist by trade, and I suppose a rhetoric geek by inclination and by history. When I was a student, I studied English literature at Oxford, and while I was there, I got kind of slightly entranced by this, at the time, very minority sort of area of study. I mean, at the time, and still quite minority area of study. One of my earliest kind of candidates for a desert island book is Richard A. Lenham's Hand List of Rhetorical Terms, which is this fantastically scholarly but also very sort of spry and funny and endlessly interesting sort of A to Z of all the figures of rhetoric and all the sort of different, you know, ancient rhetorical terms, which has remained in print and is still more or less the Bible to anyone interested in my field. In 2008, when Barack Obama had just been elected president of the US, and I had just been elected unemployed by my last employer, the Daily Telegraph, whom I spent 10 years working, but I was a victim of one of the many rounds of cuts and redundancies that went on. So I was suddenly kind of out in the market as a freelance, and one of the people I met was an editor from the FT, Financial Times weekend magazine in the UK. And I had a drink with her, and we, you know, she said, well, what are you interested in at the moment? And I said, well, Obama's language. You know, I mean, everybody was. But I said, I think, you know, his use of rhetoric actually is so conscious and so artful and so unashamed and unabashed use of the high style. I said, I think there'd be a great article to be written on, you know, how he's actually using language according to the traditional rhetorical categories. And so anyway, I wrote this piece for the FT, slightly apologetically saying, look, there's an awful lot of kind of Greek and Latin in it. And I can kind of cut that back if you think it's a bit too difficult for your readers. And they kept saying, no, more, put more Greek and Latin in it, make it more arcane. And so, you know, joyfully I did produce this big piece. And actually the upshot was the publisher came to me and said, Profile Books in the UK, and they said, you know, I think there's a book in this. I mean, my first instinct was to think they were absolutely off their onions, on the grounds that, you know, it does have a lot of Greek and Latin in it. It looks, on superficial inspection, I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating, but it didn't seem to me like an obvious kind of, you know, big selling popular book. And I mean, my publisher was obviously, he was determined, and I think he was encouraged because rhetoric, as I'm sure your listeners will know, is one third of the trivium in classical educational, medieval and Renaissance educational terms, you know, grammar, logic and rhetoric. And he'd done a book on grammar, which was Eats, Shoots and Leaves, which had been hugely successful. And so I thought maybe he's trying to knock off the trivium. And I said, you know, Christ, well, there's a market, I know, for this book in grammar, because everyone's got a very strong opinion on, you know, the placement of the apostrophe in possessive nouns. Very few lay people have a very strong opinion on the correct use of apodeoxis or zeugma or katakresis or whatever, you know, whatever Greek or Roman term you need. But anyway, he pressed me and he pressed me. And so finally I wrote the book. And by the end of it, I thought, yeah, he was right. There is a book in this. I mean, it may not have been the book I wrote, but I hope I got somewhere in the right direction. I mean, the idea, I suppose, I mean, saying, you know, a publisher asked me to write it is a glib answer. I mean, as I wrote it, what I was keeping in mind was exactly the thing that had made it such an interesting subject to me in the first place, is that here is a kind of enormous body of knowledge that goes back a very long way and has played an absolutely central part in our, not only our kind of linguistic and artistic cultures, but in our political culture. And this body of knowledge has become sort of forgotten or marginalized as a sort of descriptive tool. You know, very few people, you know, many people will use tricolons in their day-to-day language, actually, and, you know, erotema, rhetorical questions. All, a lot of the figures we use and a lot of the, you know, classical precepts of rhetoric we use in everyday persuasion. And yet we've lost the vocabulary to talk about it, which is, it seems to me, peculiar, and it's a kind of potentially quite an important gap. I mean, I suppose really what I thought was, you know, all this stuff in Lanham was true 2,000 years ago, and it hasn't ceased to be true. And isn't it worth us still knowing about it?
Yes, you make the point that in connection with Obama, that there was very much more focus on his rhetorical strategies because he uses the high style to a greater extent than has been common recently. You also talk about in your introduction anti-rhetoric as a rhetorical strategy in itself, which of course has also been around a long time. Do you feel that there is now sufficient focus, that the time is ripe for that renaissance of interest that you talk about?
Well, I think, I mean, as I use rhetoric, you know, in the book, and as I think this is the right way to use it as a term, I mean, there's part of my project is to reclaim it in a way, because quite often now the word itself is taken to mean a sort of self-delighting and probably somewhat slippery use of the high style. I mean, you hear people denouncing, you know, this is his rhetoric, let's put aside the rhetoric. And my case is really that, you know, rhetoric is present everywhere we're trying to use language, and indeed there are visual rhetorics as well, but every time we're trying to use language to persuade each other, and that the mistrust of rhetoric, you know, is itself, it's in itself a rhetorical strategy, and that an understanding of, you know, the fact that rhetoric is, you know, as the ancient Anglo-Saxons said, you know, words with full of ad, you know, fate is, you know, fully ordained, it's all around us, you can't get away from it. And I think the same is true of rhetoric, you know, it's absolutely inescapable. And, you know, one of the oldest rhetorical tricks in the book is to say what the other guy is doing is rhetoric, that he's using an acquired art to dupe you, whereas what I'm doing is speaking like a plain, honest man from the heart. I mean, you see that in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, you know, the classic instances when Mark Antony says, I am no orator, as Brutus is, but as you know me all, a plain, blunt man. And of course, he's an absolute crock. He's a much, much greater orator than Brutus. Brutus is positively inept, but he gives himself an even greater head start by instantly instructing the audience to mistrust Brutus as a kind of glozing tempter, and look only to his own, you know, plain and unvarnished words. When you see people attacking Obama, and the very obvious point to make really is that, you know, his opponents will say, oh, he's a man of fine words and no actions. He's a He's a persuader. He's a fancy talker. He's a college professor who's putting wool over the plain American's eyes. You know, these guys didn't cease to make speeches. They didn't start campaigning in you know, mime or posting plasticine sculptures rather than, say, leaflets through people's letterboxes. They didn't, you know, put interpretive dance ads instead of, you know, campaigning attack ads on the TV. So in a sense, what, you know, their disavowal of Obama as an orator was as much as simply to say, we want our politicians to make speeches, we just don't want them to be too good at it. The trouble with that attack is it's bogus, but it's also effective. Mark Antony's attack was effective. George W. Bush's inarticulacy did him a lot less damage. In fact, it probably did him some good at the polls. And Obama, certainly now, I mean, you know, in 2008, people were buying what he was selling, and that high style seemed thrilling and transformative. And after many years of having a president who, by the end of it, at least, seemed to have left things in a bit of a mess, you know, there was this unpopular war, the House seemed very divided, and there was a sort of sense that, you know, we've tried a guy who's, you know, just speaks his mind and shoots from the hip. Here is somebody who seems utterly in control, highly intelligent, absolutely on top of things. And people sort of suddenly responded to that, and they wanted this elevated, high style that Obama was selling. Now, actually, I think it is much more harmful to him, in the sense that quality that was attractive about Obama in the early days of, you know, if you read accounts of his campaign, he's almost got a catchphrase is when all of his apparatchiks are going nuts because some gaffe has been detected or a new attack ad's been run or their opponents have come up with another, you know, the Republicans come up with another statistic that's damaging or a smear or whatever. Everybody would be running around like a chicken with their heads cut off. And Obama would say, chill the f out. I got this. And he was this figure whose pulse never seemed to rise above 40 or whatever, you know. And that was, again, very reassuring and effective in times of crisis. But now I think his sang-froid is being used against him because while Main Street is hurting, he seems and is being painted consciously by his opponents as someone who's collegiate, Ivy League, worked as a sort of politician, has never done a proper job in his life. You know, he's been in the voluntary sector and he's worked in the law and he's, you know, but always in a sort of quasi political position. He's being painted as a kind of college professor whose calm is not a sign of a mastery of the situation, but of a detachment, of an inability to empathize. And, you know, one of the foundational principles of rhetoric is that you need your audience to feel that you're one of them.
Is there a sense in which you think Obama's high style is itself something of a pose, that he's, if you like, taken a particular rhetorical attitude and decided to stick with it, and his detractors have taken a particular anti-rhetoric line and are deciding to stick with that, even if they're capable of a more transformational style?
Yeah, I think certainly, I don't know whether pose is the word I'd use. I think there's a positioning going on with both of them. And if it doesn't sound too kind of crude to say, there is a sense in which the Republicans do a lot. I mean, even though paradoxically, you know, in some ways they are a party that represents elites, there is a much more kind of grassrootsy sort of talk to the dumb guy feel about the way Republican politics is at the moment, particularly with that kind of, you know, the Tea Party talk radio rhetorical race to the bottom of being angrier and more willfully kind of don't you bring your fancy arguments here, mister, about them. And so I think, you know, I mean, you look at people like Herman Cain and, you know, Rick Perry and even Mitt Romney, actually. And, you know, I don't see those guys actually being able to master the Obama high style quite. I mean, I don't think they're that accomplished as orators, but they'd get there. They could certainly talk a better game, if you like. I mean, I think there's that kind of good old boy pose at the moment goes down very, very well with the Republicans, and the sort of Sarah Palin, we're just here being mavericky kind of line. a lot of very, very profoundly inarticulate people have been have got a very long way in the Republican Party recently and in the Republican conversation. And I mean, it's true of all politicians that they, by and large, try and present themselves in terms of the ethos appeal, in terms of the way they put themselves across. You know, all politicians construct to an extent, I'm one of you thing, whereas actually, you know, nobody who gets into the position of running for president or vice president in the United States of America is by a long chalk an ordinary guy. All politicians do the ordinary guy shtick, but I think by and large, it's, you know, the Republicans strive to be that much more ordinary.
The idea that there's a sort of mistrust of the rhetorical gift goes back a long way, as you mentioned again in your introduction. In fact, you described this as, or characterised Plato's position as this, with regard to Aristotle.
I hope I don't underread Plato, but I think, you know, it's when you look at Gorgias, you know, which is the sort of classic text as the sort of anti-rhetoric, there's certainly a mistrust there. And of course, Plato's great mentor was Socrates, and Socrates is, you know, was in Plato's mind, you know, the victim of the fearsome, scary, changeable moods of the mob. Plato mistrusted the mob. His, you know, his ideal republic was not one that was a democracy. And of course, rhetoric goes hand in hand with democracy. So, you know, also Plato's habits of mind, I think. He was, in a sense, you know, and I'm speaking in kind of very, very crude and caricatural kind of philosophical terms, but, you know, he was kind of a mathematician. You know, he was interested in the sort of pure forms and the sort of abstractions. I think what's fascinating about Aristotle is, as well as being a kind of disciple of Plato, he finds a sort of different way into it. And I think he sees, he's almost as if, you know, we've got these shadows on the cave wall to cope with, and they're not perfect, and they're muddy, and they're difficult, and rhetoric doesn't produce the sort of absolutely perfect truths that logic does. You know, it doesn't, you don't get premise A and premise B and combine them to produce, you know, outcome C by the sort of iron chain of induction. You instead have what Aristotle described as sort of enthymemes, in the sort of logical or quasi-logical side of aspect of rhetoric. And he said that an enthymeme is a sort of rhetorical equivalent of a syllogism. But the point about an enthymeme is that where a syllogism works absolutely with perfect clarity, sort of black and white, an enthymeme is a sort of muddy syllogism. It has a suppressed premise, he said, or it's a kind of half-assed syllogism. It'll work on not absolute sort of axioms, but on probabilities. And so, you know, rhetoric is the sort of, is the art of the sublunary world. And Aristotle, I think, saw that, you know, this is, if you can see how people are persuaded, and they're persuaded on the balance of probabilities, not only about future events, but about the past in the law courts, you're looking for reasonable doubt. You know, to understand how it works is actually to complete a considerable inquiry into human nature itself. And I think Plato was less interested in human nature.
But I sense from your description of Aristotle's work in the book that this is something you particularly admire about his hands-on, if you like, his practical approach to the real world.
I do. He was, I mean, you know, Aristotle, my goodness, you know, rhetoric was only a tiny part of what he gave us. And, but, you know, I love that, you know, where you can imagine Plato sort of sitting, contemplating on the perfect notion of a squid, you know, Aristotle would go, I wonder how squid works. And he'd just take a sharp knife and chop one open, as he did. You know, he did a lot of dissection. He was sort of extraordinarily curious about the world around us, you know, as it was. And I find that kind of pragmatism admirable. And there was also actually an even deeper, or, well, possibly a shallower pragmatism at work with Aristotle, in that he needed the work. And when he was in Athens, you know, he didn't get the gig running the gymnasium. So he had to set up his own school. And Isocrates was at the time making a roaring trade in instructing people in rhetoric, which was all the rage. So Aristotle really had to put rhetoric on his curriculum if he was going to prosper.
Yes, you provide the historical context and vividly depict the jury system in ancient Athens, which of course you make the point this is the fundamental reason for the emergence of rhetoric as a particular tradition of study, this practicality of the usability rather of rhetoric among the upper classes?
Yes, it was a jury system, and I suppose probably the law courts, but it was the law courts actually, and the sort of deliberative bodies as well. In a sense, you know, I mean, the two, as I say, I think slightly facetiously, but with serious intent in my introduction, if you ask what's rhetoric ever done for us, in the manner of that Monty Python, what have the Romans ever done for us, you'd have to say pretty much the whole of Western civilization. I mean, you know, the two big buildings downtown in any Western capital are the law courts and the parliament. And they're both essentially, you know, temples to the idea that having an argument is the way to settle public affairs. You know, the persuasive, you know, the judicial rhetoric about the past that you find in the law courts, and deliberative oratory, which is what you find in a parliament. And so it was not only the fact that the average Athenian would expect to be dragged into court, I think something between 3 and 10 times in the course of his life in ancient Athens, but the fact that, you know, the aristocratic caste, which had for a long time basically held sway in Athens, as democracy kind of expanded, they found that they had to work a bit harder to hang on to their prerogatives and to hang on to their place in the sort of deliberative setup. And they needed to learn to justify their power by talking. And so they did what aristocrats have, you know, since time immemorial, which was buy some teachers and get some crib sheets. And that was where the teachers of rhetoric came in.
And it's essentially the case that this tradition remains rooted in the classical until the Renaissance and somewhat later in certain cases. Is that not so?
Well, there's a sort of baton passing that goes on, and the baton does disappear underground a bit, as did many of Aristotle's works. And I'm not an expert on the textual transmission, but roughly, Aristotle's rhetoric was sort of lost in a cellar somewhere in the Middle East for many, many years, and sort of rediscovered, you know, later on. And so there was a sort of plural kind of transmission, you know, because it went through Arabic and was then returned in the sort of 12th century, 13th century, early medieval Renaissance back to the West. You know, so it sort of jinked across in translation. But there was the Greek tradition, and then the Romans drew on the Greeks. And then, you know, then we had the Dark Ages. And then rhetoric came surging back along with the discovery of which we all know, you know, the sort of humanistic discovery of classical knowledge, that sort of bounded on from the sort of first Renaissance and the medieval period up to the Renaissance later on. And it survived in the trivium, which I mentioned earlier. You know, rhetoric was a central part of an educated person's education. You know, it was what was taught at grammar schools, pretty much right up until the beginning of the 19th century, I'd say.
An interesting figure you talk about from later in that tradition, I think the 16th, 17th century, is George Puttenham, whose work I wasn't too familiar with. Perhaps you could tell us a little about that.
Well, Puttenham, I mean, I'm afraid I think my approach to Puttenham probably is, and in fact, I should, you know, warn your readers that my approach to my whole subject probably is one that shows the marks of the journalist, you know, as much as, if not even before, the scholar. And Puttenham, I was kind of entranced by Puttenham's position in the history of rhetoric, is he was responsible, and the figures I've mentioned, which are, you know, all those Greco-Latin terms for the twists and turns of language you find in rhetoric, forms of repetition, sound effects, you know, ways you frame arguments, you know, the sort of all the technical jargon. He launched a kind of heroic attempt to render them into English. And so he gave, you know, sort of zeugma, which is where a single verb governs a number of different clauses, he called the single supply. And the one my favorite of his actually is that he liked to call micturismus, which is an expression of disdain accompanied by an appropriate gesture, which many of us would have seen while driving our cars. He liked to call that the fleering frump. So he is a sort of curiosity in the history of rhetoric. I mean, these particular terms that he came out with, you know, they didn't survive really, except in the pages of Lenham's Handlist of Rhetorical Terms. But they were part of a book he wrote called The Art of English Poesy, which was regarded for a very long time as this central text in kind of Elizabethan courtly poetics. It was all about how to write decorous and courtly poetry, because of course, you know, as I think should, you know, should be or should become clear, mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about the figures of rhetoric, they overlap substantially with poetics. You know, in rhetoric was the way we spoke about language and its twists and turns and how it operates in its heightened form, before we had the vocabulary of linguistics or the discipline of linguistics, and before we had anything like literary criticism. So you would talk about a poem, or the vocabulary you'd use to talk about poetry was substantially overlapped with the vocabulary used to talk about drama and oration. And so it isn't odd that these terms of the figures should have appeared in a book which was actually a book of English poesy, The Art of English Poesy. Anyway, Putnam, I looked into, actually, you know, in preparing this book, I thought I need to have a section on Putnam. I need to talk about and find out who this guy was. And to my absolute delight, it turned out that far from being the genteel Elizabethan courtier history had mostly taken him for, he was a complete scoundrel and a rogue. The closest he ever got to court was being routinely summoned for non-payment of alimony and various vicious assaults on his local vicar. His beard he would kind of occasionally turn up and try and pull out. And he was an absolutely a serial sex offender. He was a really, really bad man. And I thought at the end it was kind of quite a good, I mean, there was one wonderful, terrible scene in which his extremely long-suffering wife wrote to him rather starchily to say that she happened to have chanced in a sort of spare room in the castle on a 16-year-old girl whom he'd kidnapped as his sex slave and had set her free. And she said, you know, I have in, come into my possession a damsel. She confesses for your own tooth. So anyway, very bad hat, this guy. But the I almost think he then becomes a kind of perfect example of what better epitaph for a guy who was a champion of the art of rhetoric than that he should have completely misrepresented himself and so successfully to generations of posterity.
Yes, it's that transformative power again, isn't it?
Precisely.
The rest of your book follows in some sense quite traditional lines in its organisation. You discuss in turn the five canons of rhetoric and then three branches of oratory. Do you feel the weight of tradition pressing you to organise the discussion in this kind of way?
No, there were a couple of things that were, you know, were working on me there. One of which was the very simple, it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, I read what Cicero and Aristotle and Quintilian and all these other authorities had to say about rhetoric, and they all substantially agreed with each other, or built on each other. And I thought, you know, who am I to disagree? I also felt that what I wanted to produce was a book which would have a respectable scholarly spine underneath it. I mean, not in the sense that I'm a technical scholar, but that, you know, nothing in it would be wrong, that it, and that by the end of it, that you'd have read a book which has a lot of, you know, quite silly jokes in it and a lot of kind of high-spirited, larky kind of modern examples. And a sort of relatively highbrow, lowbrow sort of tone. But that by the end of it, you would actually, if you'd read it carefully, have a fairly faithful idea, you know, almost despite yourself, of what the various ancient authorities had to say about how rhetoric worked and what, you know, what the tradition of teaching about it is. I mean, you know, looking about the marketplace, I found there's another book, which is a very, very good book, which has exactly the same sort of grounding, you know, I'm sure substantially the same bibliography, which is Jay Heinrichs's book called Winning Arguments. I can't remember, it's got a different title in the US or a different title in the UK, which is a very, very good book. But Heinrichs was concerned, I think, to take the classical traditions and put them into a kind of modern how-to manual almost. Which, you know, is in the handbook tradition. And I didn't want my book quite to be a handbook so much as to be, you know, something that would sort of tell you in quite a straight way how rhetoric was traditionally thought about and why these weren't such stupid ways to think about it.
Indeed. And one departure from the traditional setup is that you interleave these chapters with some examples of champions of rhetoric, as you describe it.
Yes, they were originally going to be heroes of rhetoric, but my publisher thought that since they included Adolf Hitler, there was and Satan, there was a danger of kind of implicitly valorizing them morally, so they became champions instead. It's a more value neutral term.
Yes, sounds fair. What made you pick these, not with particular reference to the devil and Adolf Hitler, but what made you pick these individuals generally?
Well, again, I was wanting to, I sort of didn't want to be too clever about it. I wanted these to be people who, the average reader would have heard of, would have reason to think, or, reason to be interested in hearing why were accomplished orators. And they kind of led on quite easily the one to the other. I mean, I was keen again that, this was supposed to, I know it's a sort of tedious thing to do, to always go, well, I wanted it to be relevant. But I wanted the book to deliver its sort of payload of, as it were, quasi-academic knowledge in a way that was maximally digestible. If you're asking people to deal with a lot of terms like epizeuxis and mesozeugma, you want to do everything you can to explain why these terms are not to be frightened of, or why they actually are describing quite workaday things. And I thought the best way to do that was to find examples that would be half familiar to people already, and then go, look, here's Obama's speech you'll have heard of, here's Winston Churchill's speech you'll well remember. Let's look at it a bit more closely, break it down. This is how it works. And guess what? The fact that these three terms ascending in order appear like that is something that you'd find described in Cicero 2,000 years before. And I thought that was it was a sort of decent way of partly, some of them chose themselves, like Cicero, because I think you can't really have a book about rhetoric that doesn't mention Cicero or make a little space in its heart for him. But others of them, the one that was most, I suppose, most unusual, perhaps, or most arguably, I don't want to say controversial, but was I did a final chapter talking about, which was dedicated to the unknown speechwriter, because I wanted to, bring in this idea, which again goes back to ancient Athens and the logographoi, that, the person speaking isn't always the person who's written the speech, but that's not necessarily to say that the relationship between those two is a sort of straightforward or facile or deceptive one. Speechwriters and the people they write for have an interesting and I think quite complex relationship.
Does that reflect a sort of journalistic interest in the power behind the throne?
Yes, it probably does, actually. Probably also that, most of the journalists, most of the people I know and the people of my disposition and temperament are very much happier. Their safe place is sitting behind their keyboard and not standing up in front of a bunch of people talking at them. And I think certainly I wouldn't really expect to be giving political speeches myself anytime soon. But I have many friends who've worked as speechwriters or have left being speechwriters to become journalists. So that seems much more obvious. I mean, actually, one of the downsides of the book was that, of course, in going around promoting it, one's expected to give speeches. And of course, because you've written a book about rhetoric, one's expected to give a speech that's quite impressive. And I always sort of say in a kind of slightly feeble way, I think of myself as a dance critic rather than a ballerina. But it's a distinction that's by and large lost on audiences.
I must say the same thing is pretty predominant in linguistics. People assume that people in linguistics are going to be able to express themselves clearly and cogently, and it's sometimes the case, but
yes.
I also assume we can all speak many languages, which is certainly not the case in my...
Yeah, I'm sure that would be a classic sort of obvious side effect. People think that a linguist is someone who does linguistics, but it's not necessarily the same thing, is it?
Well, no, but I have heard it said that to ask a linguist in the linguistic sense how many languages they speak is like asking a doctor how many diseases they suffer from.
Oh, yes, that's very good. That's a good line.
So turning to the... canons of rhetoric, you discuss first invention, under which heading you, among other things, give some very nice examples of misdirected or unsuccessful ethos appeals. You make the general point that rhetorical strategies are sometimes more noticeable when they go wrong. Does a particular instance of this stand out in your recollection?
I'm now going to be instantly, obviously, go blank. The one that, I mean, there was a recent one that I think what's really interesting is that, while looking at, the US presidential race, which is obviously, front and center in many of our minds, is watching as a reference what I said earlier, that, all presidents trying to present themselves as, just a normal guy. And Mitt Romney has a harder task than most in doing that, because he's a millionaire son of a millionaire father. He's the state governor son of a state governor father. He's got a lot of sort of inherited privilege and fast track to live down. And so he does a lot of this. I mean, a lot of his speeches he talks about saying, "No, I lived the American dream. When I was a young man, I got together with a few friends and I did what I'd always wanted to do, and we got together and we left our jobs and we went and started up our own company and, built it up from a few people in an office to, whatever it became." And of course, he always, elides the nature of that company, because actually it was a sort of finance capital outfit with $37 million under management. And, it wasn't exactly like Bain Capital was starting up a kind of mom and pop motorcycle repair shop. And he launched a fan terrible. It's when he ad-libs, Mitt goes terribly wrong. And when he was in Detroit, I don't know whether you remember seeing this, who's in the sort of the wreckage of Motor City, giving a speech to a surprisingly few people, I think, in a football stadium. And he said, "Oh, I love Detroit. It's great here, and I love your automobile industry, which obviously is more or less vanished off the face of the earth." And he said, I, for example, I to try and obviously talk about how much he, esteemed the American automobile industry. He said, "I drive two cars and my wife drives two other cars," or something. And you're like, oh, you don't come to an incredibly depressed kind of Rust Belt type city and tell everybody that you have four cars. As a presidential candidate, it's not a good move.
Do you think it's becoming increasingly difficult for presidential candidates to launch compelling ethos appeals?
I think it is difficult to launch an ethos appeal, as it were, in good faith. As I say, the nature of American politics is now that, in order to even get a presidential run off the ground, you have to have a fabulous amount of money, not necessarily personally, but you have to be able to tap into the sorts of corporate interests. You can't simply start up and, decide one day from the comfort of your middle class job in America that you're going to run for president. And yet it is in the nature of all presidential candidates to present themselves exactly as if, that's what they did. And so I think a lot of the ethos appeal now is done with an almost sort of set vocabulary of visual ethos appeals. And there's always the arm around the wife, the one arm around the wife's waist, the other one saluting the crowd. The happy families appeal. There's the whole business of, being pictured wearing a baseball cap at a backyard cookout, launching an opening pitch, going to the ball game, eating a hot dog, doing all the sort of, so to speak, boilerplate, this is what America, middle America is about things. I mean, do you remember when Sarah Palin made that terrible kind of intervention after about 3 days too late after the shooting of Gabby Giffords, when Obama?
Something you bring up in one of your later chapters.
Yeah, and Obama had played a complete blinder there, and Palin sort of went on telly, but the set dressing for this very stiff and awkward video she made, for internet release, a sort of straight to camera piece, but she was by a fireplace with a kind of American flag on the mantelpiece, and the whole set dressing for it was at once sort of cheesy American dream stuff in a very kind of straightforward ethos appeal way, but it was also, you just thought, no human being's living room looks like that. It was a so I think it's almost become caricatural now, the way presidential candidates and wannabes make their ethos appeals.
Reminds me of some abstract level of Dave Barry writing about 25 years ago, as proposing the motto of the US Senate as white male millionaires working for you.
Yes, exactly. No, that's dead on. That's dead on.
Tell me that in the next section you discuss arrangement And again, make use of a wonderfully wide range of examples. Again, the impression I have is that there are certain aspects of the structure of a rhetorical speech that it's easier to spot a good instance of, perhaps the exordium or the peroration, than to find, for example, a rhetorically powerful proof that makes sense out of context.
Yes.
Is that your impression?
Yeah, that is my impression. I mean, I sort of... Part of me inclines, though I think I use the sort of Ciceronian or Quintilian, Cicero stroke Quintilian, you know, late Roman sort of five-part structure of narration. But part of me basically agrees with Aristotle that just says there's two halves, the beginning and the end. You can divide speeches very carefully into, narration and digression and the sort of division. I find by and large, even sort of trying to look at a really classic speech, often it's a bit harder to split it neatly into those sections than you'd like it to be. I mean, I think they're good categories for thinking about while you're composing a speech, and by and large, they're not actually, completely how most speeches work.
Do you think that's itself significant, that there's some aspect of, if you like, a jazz-like improvisation in which these things are played with?
I think there certainly is. And I think it's, for something, as I'm sure the same would apply in linguistics, for something to have analytic usefulness as a category is not the same as saying that the things you're analysing, neatly divide along the lines of your analytic categories. Ethos, pathos and logos. There are very few kind of appeals that won't somehow how kind of mix those things. And likewise, judicial oratory comes with a tincture of forensic. There's always, the different branches of oratory kind of interpenetrate and intermingle. I mean, you might well be arguing ostensibly that you should be the next president of the United States, but you might well be doing so on the basis of defending your record, which would be a judicial instance, and obviously there's a strong epideictic content in the self-praise involved. So I think these categories are much blurrier in practice than any given example could be an example of one of several things, but that doesn't mean, I think, if that makes sense, that the analytic categories are themselves kind of redundant.
Sure. I mean, another way in which that in which the categorization breaks down or is sort of negotiable is, for instance, the fourth part of rhetoric, as you discuss here, is memory, which relates in particular to the way in which a classical oration would be prepared.
Well,
it's something that's very much more variable, how this is used, how this is treated in contemporary discourse, isn't it?
Yes, memory is a sort of... It was very interesting to me. I had to fight quite hard to be allowed to keep as much of that chapter in as I did, because in some ways it's a sidetrack, or aspects of it are, because a lot of the sort of history, the classical history of rhetoric and rhetorical study talks about those classical memory techniques, the method of Locke, what gets popularly known as kind of memory palaces. And they're found in the sort of apocryphally Ciceronian book Ad Herennium, sort of handbook, Roman handbook. And Ad Herennium talks about memory palaces and the artificial memory and the method of Locke. And that, of course, is, almost kind of comically unimportant in terms of modern, rhetoric as you'd see it. Very few people practice the artificial memory except professional mnemonists. But it's part of the history of the subject. And it's just sort of sidetracked, that's gone somewhere else, as so many of them have. One of the interesting things I thought in this whole history of the artificial memory was how it went off into, through a series of misprisions, actually, of ancient texts. Augustine and Aquinas kind of Christianized the ancient method of Locke and these bizarre memory techniques, and produced this kind of baroque medieval history of memory palaces, which ends up having very little to do with classical rhetoric or rhetoric at all. However, memory and rhetoric remain kind of intimately involved, in as much as in ancient terms, you simply had to remember your speech because you wouldn't have had anywhere to write it down. But in a less banal way, your ability to kind of take possession of your speech and your memory, your ability to, even in the age of the teleprompter or notes, to be able to kind of own the speech and kind of have it live in your head, rather than to parrot it, but to actually kind of have it fully internalized, is, it seems to me, extremely important in that, you know, all important quality of sprezzatura, you know, of sounding spontaneous, of seeming to kind of sure. come upon your arguments as fresh rather than recite them from something you've learnt off a sheet of paper.
At this point, I'd like to, in accordance with my planned question, which I must admit, to turn to the section of your book dealing with the different categories of oratory, as they're characterised here, the deliberative, forensic and epideictic.
Yeah.
In giving the example of deliberative rhetoric, you discuss, well, people ranging from Demosthenes to Simon Jenkins. In both cases, careful analysis tends to weaken the argument presented, which of course takes us back to Plato and his objection to rhetoric in general. Do you think that that phenomenon of being weaker under the microscope is diagnostic of deliberative rhetoric as it's used?
I don't think that's particularly true of deliberative rhetoric. I think it's probably true of all rhetoric, in the sense that very often seeming to be the junior partner in the three rhetorical appeals, ethos, pathos, and logos, is the actual, the sort of logical development of the argument, because so much of what succeeds in persuading is ethos, is the speaker's kind of credibility and plausibility and self-presentation, and is pathos, the sort of swaying of the audience's emotion. And by definition, when you're, I think more or less by definition, when you're actually kind of zeroing in and analyzing a piece of language, as it were, cold on the slab afterwards, you know, you can see those, the suppressed premises of the enthymemes, you can see the sort of funny leaps of logic and the strange framings, and you're by and large going to be immune to the, you know, the crowd feeling perhaps that you have if you're standing, you know, in a huge audience listening to a piece of oratory, or the excitement you might get at, you know, a felicitous phrase. It's going to be logos that's going to be on trial there. I suppose I'd say two things about that, one of which is that rhetoric is not by and large received analytically. I mean, it's kind of, it has its life somewhere other than the oratory scholar's slab. And also, this seems to go to my argument that it's helpful to us to have these tools to analyze it, because, you know, even if we're not sitting kind of forensically examining these arguments, having a sense of how rhetoric works on you is bound to make you better able to spot what's iffy in it.
This is probably a very general question, but it occurs to me to ask you, as given your literary background, do you feel it's the case that, for example, of epideictic rhetoric, of display rhetoric, that it is weakened by analysis in that you notice that it consists of these devices, or that it is in some sense strengthened by analysis because you appreciate the artistry that's gone into its construction?
I think probably in the special case of epideictic rhetoric, the idea that it's weakened would be less important because, you know, by the very term it gets of display oratory, this is something in a way that's sort of done for pleasure. You know, Cicero said that there were three aims of oratory: docere, movere, and delectare, to teach, to move, and to delight. And I think it's possible in talking about, you know, whether or not rhetoric's getting the better of us, to miss the actual pleasure that there is to be had, you know, for the same reasons that it overlaps with poetics. You know, the pleasure you get from a well-formed sonnet isn't diminished but enhanced by knowing how it works. And I think that the pleasure you get from a great speech, you know, you might be able to analyze the speech and see that actually, you know, perhaps what it's selling isn't something you should be buying, but still take delight in the artistry of it. And I think for the generations that saw rhetoric in some ways as entertainment. You know, they didn't have the Xbox, so they went to the Agora. You know, there was certainly, that was front and center. And, it, you know, poor old Churchill, there's a good contemporary quote about Churchill demonstrating more or less exactly what I've said, which is that for many years, you know, whenever he spoke, MPs would flock into the house and they'd hang on his every words and they'd be, you know, roar with laughter at his jokes, and they'd thrill to his, you know, high-flown bouts of language. And at the end of it, they would vote against him. So clearly, Winston Churchill's contemporaries were well able to appreciate the artistry of a piece of rhetoric without necessarily falling for it.
You mentioned that you think epideictic rhetoric is somewhat underappreciated or neglected by, with reference to the particularly the other branches of rhetoric, which are of course constantly with us.
Well, I think it's sort of under noticed. I mean, it seems like an odd one out because I think we by and large, you know, are less accustomed to thinking of rhetoric as a form of entertainment, and it's more obviously geared to that. But it's much more present, albeit in a sort of less sinister way, in most of our day-to-day lives, because we will, you know, if we're ever called upon to give a set piece of speech, the chances are, unless we're lawyers or politicians, which most of us aren't, it will be a speech at a funeral or a speech at a wedding or a speech at, you know, a colleague's retirement party. And so, you know, these are epideictic rhetoric. You know, you're saying nice or nasty things about the groom, or you're, you know, paying tribute to old Franz Barnes, who's retiring on his 65th birthday. So I think it's still there. But I think it occupies a sort of different place in most of our lives and in most of our ways of thinking about rhetoric than probably the other two sorts, which are always up in our face.
Our time is nearly up in this interview. I would like to ask, presuming that you're not about to announce your bid for a political office, based on what you said earlier, what the immediate future holds for your work?
Well, I'm going to continue to churn out hack journalism because that's you know, that's what I do. I do a lot of book reviewing and a lot of sort of general journalism in the British papers, which I enjoy enormously and which pays my bills. Unfortunately, the giant rhetoric revival that I was hoping my book would spark has it's smouldering, but it hasn't yet sort of burst into towering inferno style flame, guaranteeing my book a place on every curriculum. I have a proposal for a book out at the moment, which is quite different. I don't know how it will go or whether anyone will want to publish it. But actually, I want to write about video games. It just seems to me that given they're now, you know, bar none, the most popular, you know, lucrative art form or entertainment sector, if you like, there's remarkably little sort of serious writing about them. And I'd like to see more, and I'd like to do some of it, partly from a critical point of view. I mean, I think, you know, I like to think that video games, you know, they need their critics. I mean, sort of rather than sort of PR boosterism, you know, some sort of serious critical thinking about it. But also, almost, I wanted to see, because I haven't seen it written before, how a sort of memoiry treatment of what it's actually like having been a member of the first generation, as I am, that really grew up with them, you know, that was sort of 10 when the BBCB was, you know, Elite came out or whatever. And, you know, 20-ish when the first PlayStation appeared, and therefore to sort of just try and write about what it felt like to be part of that moment, and the question of where you actually go to when you spend 14 hours in World of Warcraft.
Well, it sounds an interesting project and unique in the experience of asking people about what they're going to do next.
Yes, but... no, I'm sorry, it's probably most of your interviews probably go, I'm going to write another book on, you know, predicate adjectives or whatever. No, sorry.
That's okay. I think makes a very refreshing change. If you write a book on predicate adjectives, I would be very happy to talk to you about it. If you write a book on video games, I'd be very happy to talk to you about it if I can convince people that it's about language.
I'll have to work on that.
But in the meantime, Sam Leith, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.
I've been talking to Sam Leith about his book, Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.